Hello everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics, manga, and everything in between. I'm Andrew, and as per usual, I'm joined by my co-host Rob.
Hello!
And Mick.
Hello!
That's almost a competent introduction, isn't it?
That was a competent introduction until you said, that's almost a competent introduction.
I know, I got too scared, I had to sabotage.
Who'd have thunk the week you got that close, you'd be the weakling?
Oh, so how was everyone this week? How are you feeling, Mick, after your religious experience?
I feel cleansed and raring to go. And thanks for bringing that up on a public forum.
No, it's okay, because if there's one thing the 4Panel audience loves, it's jokes that literally only the 2 out of 3 hosts of this podcast enjoy.
Yeah.
Oh, how are you, Andrew?
Not good. I have the hay fevers. My face is melting. I think this might be the end.
Or it could be the beginning. We could do a series of low-budget movies. Call you the Hay Fever Avenger.
Or we just utilise it to do a zero-budget Toxic Avenger film.
Right, so I'm just going to look at all my notes about how that gag was going to lead into, but I will be reborn because I am Fire and Life incarnate, and we'll just scrap that. We're talking about the Phoenix, everyone.
Yes. Oh.
The Phoenix.
My brain already hurts.
Yeah. So, like a dark harbinger of some kind of mostly adequate apocalypse, the Dark Phoenix movie is nearly upon us.
What I'd like you to do, Andrew, is I'd like you to treat me as someone who's never heard of the Dark Phoenix.
Not even from hit film X-Men 3.
No, it wasn't called X-Men 3, it was just called X-3, wasn't it?
Well, you see, this brings me back to my psychological issue with the X-Men franchise.
Oh, that you don't remember any of them.
I know I've seen them all. I've got them all. I can see them all here in the box set. But I can't remember what happens in which ones. Is this where Sulky Stark goes bad?
Oh, no, this is the one where the old version of Sulky Stark, that's where she went bad, and now we've looped back around to the point where Sulky Stark is going to be bad like her, but in the past.
Okay.
Or as I know her, Stanna Stark. She makes really good stair lifts.
And if you thought that's confusing, wait till we get to the comics.
Hey!
Oh, God.
So, Phoenix. Starting at the beginning, we've got to start with Jean Grey of the X-Men. Now, Jean was one of the original X-Men created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby.
Yep.
And she was, just like a lot of female characters invented during the 1960s, bit of a wet blanket.
Yep.
She was the team psychic. She could read minds, move objects about with her brain.
Also,
well, with psychic powers, I mean, like, she couldn't, like, you know, shoot her brain out and that would pick objects up and...
Yeah.
Guys, I've just had an amazing comic idea.
She was basically the token female on the team.
Yeah. She was there mostly to kind of get overwhelmed by villains and need to be rescued by the male heroes. But then Chris Claremont came along and he was having none of that nonsense.
Yeah, he kind of took her too far the other way, didn't he?
Yeah, so what happened was in... the storyline starting in Uncanny X-Men issue 101, Chris Claremont and, well, first of all, Dave Cockrum, later John Byrne, did a story in which Jean Grey, she basically died trying to pilot a space shuttle with the X-Men on back from outer space. She basically got hit by a fatal dose of radiation and she like melted.
Yep.
It's like, I always forget that it's actually like quite a grisly scene.
There was quite literally nothing of her left.
Yeah. But what happened during that event is a cosmic force known as the Phoenix, which is basically like a big space bird made of fire, not to be confused with the Marvel superhero Firebird, basically heard Jean's kind of anguished cries and decided, you know what, why not just save this person and give her vast, almost godlike psychic powers? I can see this in no way backfiring horribly later down the road. So that happened. Jean basically was reborn as the Phoenix, who was a character that looks a lot like Jean Grey, but with a snazzier costume.
Yep. And a sash.
And a sash.
You can't beat a sash, can you?
Well,
all the best heroes have a sash.
Captain Marvel's got a sash.
You know, I bet that's why I don't like Captain America. It's because he doesn't have a sash.
Hulk may have a sash. We're not sure.
It's carried in the pockets of his purple pants.
I mean, I think Hulk sometimes has kind of like a torn up bit of shirt, which I guess is kind of like a sash.
Sash adjacent.
Mm. And when the sash gets really big, it can be a cape.
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just like Pokemon. Once you get to be a high enough level hero, your sash evolves into a cape.
Oh, actually, no. It must be the other way around. Because Captain Marvel's supposed to be like the most powerful Avenger.
Yeah.
So he must graduate up from cape to sash.
So, hang on, is the cape like training wheels for heroes, is it?
Yeah. Because only the very best heroes can balance with a sash.
It's kind of like, it's all that super heroic energy that was stored in the cape becomes kind of smaller and more focused, and so just it concentrate down into a sash.
Oh my god, I've just realised the Doctor Strange movie was right. Because if you notice, the cloak keeps giving him assistance, doesn't it?
Yep.
That's it, Avengers 5. This time it's just all the capes doing the fighting.
Yeah.
Anyway, Phoenix.
Yep. So, basically, like what you alluded to earlier, there was a bit of discontent in the X-Office about the Phoenix, because Chris Claremont basically wanted her to be sort of the X-Men's equivalent to Thor, of just the really, like, super powerful big gun hero that you call in to take care of the big threats.
Yeah.
But some other people, including artist John Byrne, who, as I feel I need to remind our audience every show, is the worst, but for once might not necessarily have been in the wrong, was kind of worried about basically having one of the X-Men be this all-powerful god, kind of moves a lot of the focus onto her and away from the other characters.
It's a fair point.
It is. I'll concede he has a point this time. And so they basically started working towards a way to get rid of the Phoenix. And that led to the Dark Phoenix saga, in which basically Jean gets controlled by a villain called Mastermind, who may or may not be the villain in Dark Phoenix. It's kind of unclear.
That was the whole Hellfire Club, wasn't it? That whole thing?
Yeah, he's basically working with the Hellfire Club to turn Jean into their new Black Queen.
Yeah, because that was when Emma Frost was the White Queen, wasn't it?
It was.
And then that leads to basically genocide.
Yeah. Jean maybe kind of a little bit eats a son because she's gone mad with power.
It's that Acton quote, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, or words to that effect.
Yeah, basically that. Anyway, she eats a son and a planet full of broccoli people die.
See, this was when the whole Phoenix thing was still pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Convoluted, but straightforward. You could still follow it. There was still a plot thread there that you could hold on to for dear life.
Exactly. So what happens next is the Shi'ar, who are basically alien, basically the Romans, but in space, and also they're kind of a bit bird-like.
Yeah, and also their Empress Lilandra is kind of Xavier's on-and-off girlfriend.
Yeah, basically his on-girlfriend until he thinks, you know, maybe having a girlfriend who's the head of, like, an empire that has enslaved countless planets, not so great. So anyway, they decide that the Phoenix is too powerful to exist, so they kind of go and try and execute her. The X-Men fight back, and it very famously ends with Jean basically deciding to use her powers to basically kill herself. Sort of going out on her own terms before the Dark Phoenix can take control again type deal.
Yep.
Although, interestingly, probably that wasn't the original plan. I think Chris Claremont's original idea was that the Shi'ar were just going to sort of permanently remove Jean's powers.
Mm.
So she was going to stick around. Editor-in-chief Jim Shooter, was very against that. basically, you know, feeling that June's getting off a bit too lightly considering she murdered a whole planet.
Again, a fair point.
Yeah. And his compromise was going to be that June basically gets sent to Shi'ar prison. But Claremont didn't like that, basically figuring, you know, the X-Men aren't just going to say, well, okay, June, you're going to go to alien prison forever now. That sucks. Bye.
Yeah.
So he settled on just killing her off. Then things get weird.
Yeah.
So, it's a couple of years later. One second,
I just want to enter into this here. If Andrew pauses at any point, I just want to point out he has gone back to the crazy wall of the Phoenix to figure out where he is in the timeline.
Yeah, it's basically that one shot from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia where Charlie's just got a whole wall of string and random pieces of paper.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. It is now January 1981, Uncanny X-Men issue 141. We are introduced to Rachel Summers, who is, of course, the daughter of Jean Grey and Cyclops. When was she born, you ask? Several years in the future, in an alternate timeline.
Because comics.
Yep. Specifically because X-Men comics.
Can I just stop there while I take a couple of paracetamol? I can feel.
Oh, come off it. He's barely got started.
I can feel a headache starting already.
You'll be on opiates by the end of the segment at this rate.
I'd say just hook up a drip. You're gonna... So Rachel is actually from another very famous X-Men storyline. And a different X-Men film called Days of Future Past, which, you know, is kind of the first sort of bad future X-Men story where Kitty Pryde has to travel back from a future where mutants are hunted by sentinels to stop that from happening. So basically that still existed kind of as a split-off timeline. Rachel is from there. She grew up as the daughter of Jean and Scott. Got turned into a mutant hunting hound by a man called Ahab. Anyway, she comes back to the present, becomes an X-Men for a little bit, ends up basically being similar enough to Jean that the Phoenix Force decides, well, it worked out so well the first time, I'm going to give this Summers girl godlike powers as well. And that works out marginally better.
See, you say marginally.
Yeah, she still goes a bit mad with power, but at least she only uses her powers to try and murder a supervillain, which, for some weird reason, Wolverine is against.
Yeah, I never understood that.
Yeah, it's this really, I would say probably one of the biggest missteps of Claremont's X-Men is Wolverine saying, no, Rachel, you murdering a supervillain is wrong. Therefore, I'm going to stab you in the chest to stop it from happening.
Because that always stops the Phoenix.
Look, he's probably been hit on the head a few times at this point.
I'm just saying, right, it's the Phoenix. And, well, I suppose at that point, they didn't know, did they?
Yeah. What they didn't know is, oh, and don't worry, Rachel gets better and then joins Excalibur, the best X-Men team. So then we get the retcon. Because, Chris Claremont, he went on to write a new X-Men book called X-Factor.
Yep.
Which is, basically, it was the original five X-Men, so Cyclops, Beast, Angel, Iceman. But, oh, wait a second, Jean's one of those original five X-Men, but she's dead. Only, no, she's not. Because it turns out what happened, right, was that Jean Grey actually wasn't the Phoenix. She put in a special healing cocoon at the bottom of the ocean by the real Phoenix, who then just took over Jean's form. Yeah, I wasn't kidding when Phoenix said that Phoenix was someone who looked like Jean Grey but in a snazzier costume. They're two different people.
See, you say that, but I've read a lot of the Phoenix stuff as well.
Yeah, yeah, they're kind of, but also not really. They have the same mind, maybe, or they don't. But problem is, Phoenix became one of those things where it's very much dependent on, like, just what the writer wants to do at the time. So anyway, Jean was alive, she wasn't the Phoenix, Rachel was the Phoenix. But she got thrown into the time stream, so there was no more Phoenix. until there was a phoenix again, because then Rachel got Jean. They're the same character. It gets so confusing.
No, because one is apparently the alternate reality daughter of the other.
She also wears lots of leather and spikes.
Yeah, and a weird shawl.
Yeah, so sometimes she wears a weird shawl. Sometimes she doesn't. I guess that was... Where does weird shawl come on? Like the cape sash axis?
I think it's, you know, when... I think it's basically midway between the training wheels and... you know, and the just basically free cycling. I think it's the training wheels are off, but you've still got someone kind of holding the back seat, ready to let you go.
Sure. So anyway, Jean was back. She wasn't the Phoenix. Then she maybe was the Phoenix in ways that weren't clear and ill-defined. But it's okay, because then she was dead.
Yeah.
And now she's not again.
Wasn't that period when she was dead the whole bit when Scott took over the Institute and had his relationship with Emma Frost and Wolverine was sitting on top of Jean's grave to kill her every time she was reborn?
Oh yeah, that was a whole thing. I assume that was a whole thing sparked by that one time that Scott and Emma kind of just got a bit frisky on top of Jean's grave.
Yeah, I think that was part of the whole thing. I think that led into that whole thing. Are you still following us, Mick?
No. My brain hurt. Do I need to know all this to go see this bloody film?
Yes.
All of it?
Yes, because then you'll be too busy thinking about how confusing and convoluted X-Men Comics continuity is, and you won't be able to focus on how, I assume, aggressively mediocre the film is.
I mean... I'm only going to see the movie to fill time until New Mutants gets released.
You're going to have to see a lot of movies then.
I guess. You see, I was intrigued when you started talking about the White Queen, because that got mentioned in one of the comics I'll be reviewing later. But I didn't want to stop your flow and ask you who the White Queen was.
Well, I did say Emma Frost.
Yeah, and I know that, and I know that from the comic I read, but I didn't understand what that meant.
Okay, so Emma Frost was a member of the Hellfire Club, which is basically...
Sebastian Shaw was part of it, wasn't he?
Yeah, they're a wannabe bondage supervillain team.
Yeah.
Full of rich people. But then she decided she would rather take her kind of thin scraps of costume elsewhere and join the X-Men, and now she's a hero. Well, except now she's maybe more of an anti-hero because she's back with the Hellfire Club.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, isn't she the Black Queen now, again?
Well, even more confusingly, no, she's the Black King.
Oh, God, yeah, sorry, the Black King.
What?
Yeah, I know, it's all bizarre.
This is why I don't read X-Men comics.
You don't read X-Men comics, yeah. You experience X-Men comics.
Yeah, it's basically, imagine the Black King is basically like the president of the Hellfire Club, whereas Black Queen is like the vice president.
Yeah.
Okay. And the White Queen?
Like the other vice president, but who dresses
what, in charge
different...
of marketing or something? Well,
I mean, I think it's kind of an even 50-50 split. The main difference is just what colour corset they wear.
Yeah.
Or don't wear, in Emma Stone's case.
Emma Frost.
Emma Frost. Emma Stone? Who the hell is Emma Stone? Where did that come from?
She's the actress who played Gwen Stacy in the Spider-Man films. She was in La La Land.
I think I am as well.
So, Dark Phoenix, the movie. The second bite at that particular storyline.
Yeah, should we talk about that?
I think we need to.
Will this movie explain to me how Sansa Stark turns into Famke Janssen?
No. Although if Sansa Stark turned into Famke Janssen at some point, I think this movie would have been slightly better.
Also, don't know if she does turn into Famke Janssen anymore. Like, is that a different timeline?
Yes.
Probably, because comics.
It's kind of perfect, isn't it, that the X-Men films have... as, if not a more convoluted continuity than the comics.
Yeah. The only continuous thing between the timelines seems to be Wolverine.
Yeah, maybe some kind of, like, universal constant. Anyway, X-Men Dark Phoenix, It just looks like something I do not want. Very, very grim, serious, kind of slightly ashamed of being a comic book movie.
Yeah. The thing that I really don't like about the Dark Phoenix movie is, well, one of the reasons you go to watch superhero movies is the costumes, yeah? You like seeing characters in the spandex punching each other in the face. That's one of the high points of it.
Okay, but what if instead they just wore a big long coat?
And mopped around in the rain a lot.
And wore jeans.
Yeah.
For some reason, it's the jeans that I really just can't get behind.
But, Andrew, and drumroll please, hasn't X-Men always been about the jeans?
Boo! Boo, sir!
I am going to go the other way, and I'm going to high-five you for that, Mick.
The worst part is, as soon as I said the word jeans, I thought, oh no, there's a pun there. I hope no one notices it.
It was a vain hope.
It was. It's like the...
My X-Gene kicked in, my mutant power of pun deciphering.
Kind of as the boat is sinking and you see the water start to pour in through the windows and you just have that moment, maybe it'll be all right, but deep down you know, no, it's not going to be all right.
Oh God. I just thought of a tagline for this episode. Call it Dark Phoenix, Mad Jeans and Mutant Men. Because that's the Dark Phoenix saga, isn't it?
I'm just imagining Scott Summers in like a Marks and Spencer's, because Marks and Spencer's is definitely where he goes clothes shopping.
Yes.
Just standing in the trousers aisle yelling, jeans! Anyway, yeah, I think the problem with the X-Men films is that they've very clearly got the same people in charge of them who were in charge like back in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And to be fair, back then, you did need to maybe step away from the comics a bit. Like, you don't have the budget for the big, weird sci-fi stuff, and probably can't really do, like, comics-accurate costumes that look good.
Yeah.
But the thing is, we're post-Infinity War now, aren't we? We're post-Avengers Endgame, even. And so you can, but Dark Phoenix was still being made during Infinity War, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, even... No, it was like...
What, you mean so potentially half the film could have just been snapped away by Thanos?
Got a point.
Damn you, Thanos!
I was just trying to think, would it be Captain America, the first Avenger? That kind of seems to me like the first Marvel film that really just went into being like the comics.
Iron Man did it to a degree, but I think I agree with you, Captain America. Yeah.
Yeah, that seems like the first one that didn't feel the need to try and change or update anything.
Yeah, and when you look at the Howling Commandos, they even had the guy with the bowler hat on his head and the mustache. I really want to know the actor's name.
At no point explained that.
Yeah, I really want to know the actor's name because he looked exactly...
Neil McDonough.
Yeah, he looked exactly like his comic book counterpart.
It's the same guy who plays Damian Dark in the Arrowverse.
Yeah, he's basically the white version of Benedict Wong.
Yeah,
yeah.
He's just in everything.
He was also the Tin Man in that reworking of the Wizard of Oz that was called Tin Man.
He was also, and this is my favourite one, M. Bison in Street Fighter The Legend of Chun-Li.
Seriously?
Yep.
Wow.
Remember that film, everyone? The gritty, serious Street Fighter reboot that we all were clamouring for.
Oh, wow. So,
just want to hear my big confession.
What?
Dark Phoenix is kind of not really my favourite X-Men story.
Was it God Loves, Man Kills?
I mean, I guess, but more in terms of I'm not actually that big a fan of it.
It does seem like one of those hugely convoluted shows that a lot of... one of those hugely complicated plot lines that a lot of Marvel comics end up being more through convenience rather than through design.
Yeah. See, the problem I've got with the X-Men timeline, the problem I've got with it is that whenever they do a reboot or a retcon or anything like that, they insist on trying to include, at some point, they will do this, they'll try and include stuff that's happened before in the past, no matter how far back it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely part of it is how a lot of things always seem to try and cram the Phoenix into everything.
Yeah.
But even the original story, it feels dark in a way I don't necessarily like.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of just Jean Grey gets screwed over by everyone and then dies. Because it's like, it's not like she made some kind of mistake, you know, like made a deal with the devil or something.
Yeah.
It's just the Phoenix arbitrarily was like, okay, you're super powerful now. And then, like, she got mind controlled and was in a whole bad situation.
See, you know when you said you're super powerful now? Oh, I'm sorry to the X-Men writers, but my brain went to Oprah Winfrey handing out cars.
Yeah, the Phoenix is just Cosmic Oprah. Hey.
Cosmic Oprah. Yes.
You get a power, you get a power, you get a power.
I mean, basically, there was a whole storyline like 2012 called Avengers vs. X-Men where the Phoenix got like split into bits and it just like glomped onto a bunch of X-Men.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that. I totally forgot about that when I made that reference.
Cyclops, you're the Phoenix now. Colossus, you're the Phoenix now. Magic, you're the Phoenix now. Emma Frost, you're the Phoenix now. Namor, you live in the water. Don't care, you're a Phoenix now.
So are you saying that this Dark Phoenix storyline is basically just a giant great game of Tag You're It?
No, it's Cosmic Oprah giving out powers. You get a power, you get a power. Everybody gets a power.
See, this would be a much better Dark Phoenix film.
Oh, I think, shall we take a break there?
Sure, let's.
I need more paracetamol. Two wasn't enough.
Four panel will be back in just a moment.
This is Sonny Strait, the voice of many of the voices that you grew up on. Yes, I raised all of you ungrateful bastards, and you're listening to The Geek Show. Kamehameha, bitches!
Hello, this is Ryan from the Geek Show Podcast Network. Do you like trees? What about paper? What about words? Yes, words are good. Then you will like Literally Loitering, all available on the Geek Show Podcast Network.
Welcome back, and now it's time for comics. We've had our head medicine, so hopefully this will all go well. Starting off is Mick.
Yes, and I'm celebrating 20 years of Marvel Knights with a collection called Marvel Knights 20th. This collects Marvel Knights 20th numbers 1 to 6 by Donny Cate, Matthew Rosenberg, Tinny Howard, Vita Ayala, Travel Foreman, Nike Henrikan, Damian Cassira, Joshua Cassara, Kim Jacinto, Derek Fridolfs, and Matt Miller. And this is my first exposure, really, to the Marvel Knights oeuvre, other than odds and sods and bits and pieces in other comics, sort of away from the Marvel Knights imprint.
Yeah.
And I've got to say, I want more.
Really? Because, to be honest, I prefer the normal Marvel where they were just lifeguards.
He got you there. He got you, Mick.
There was a brief moment where I thought, what the hell is... All right.
I did have a brief moment of panic that joke wasn't going to land.
Oh, just wait until the reboot that's done by The Rock.
So, Marvel Knights 20th starts off with Matt Murdock in front of Karen Page's grave, not knowing why he's there, not knowing who he is, not knowing who Karen Page is, and when someone sneaks up behind him and says, Daredevil, he goes, what? The someone being a detective called Castle, who also has forgotten that he's the Punisher. There's a theme here. In the back of the car is a man in the back of the patrol car that Castle takes Matt Murdock to, is a man called Bruce, who has some scraps of paper with names and symbols and descriptions of people written on them, written by children that visit him in the night or when he's asleep, this Mr. Banner.
Wait, who's a what now?
Because he can't remember what's going on either. And basically, this is the whole plot. We've got lots of heroes and villains, some of whom just make little cameos, and there's not... You know, we've mentioned in the past that sometimes Marvel have that sort of almost gratuitous shot of like a crowd of heroes who appear to be there for no apparent reason but just to have a selfie done.
Yeah, in some kind of big, nice splash page.
Yeah, they don't do that in this. You get nice little subtle cameos from people who've appeared in the Marvel Knights imprint at some point. And some of the villains don't know what's going on either because they've forgotten who they are. One of which has got a big sort of target imprinted on his forehead and he doesn't know why.
Is that basically the Marvel equivalent of like waking up after a few too many and you've got a new tattoo?
Yeah, but it's everybody.
Hang on, is this the Marvel version of The Hangover?
So Foggy Nelson doesn't recognise Matt. He doesn't know who Matt is. So consequently, when Matt tries to find some clues at his place of work, Foggy doesn't know. But his new partner, a girl called Jennifer Walters, strong arms him out of the office.
Strong arms him.
But she doesn't know who she is either, outside of she knows she's a lawyer called Jennifer Walters who works with Foggy Nelson. And it's not just a question of a loss of memory. They're not visible to people. There's like a blank spot. There's a cameo from the Fantastic Four, who don't recognise Matt Murdock. And it's a proper mystery as they try and... they try and piece together exactly what all these pieces of paper are. And obviously it transpires that Hulk can remember who these people are, but Banner can't. So Hulk has left all these clues scrawled on bits of paper for him. And they start following these clues, and eventually they figure out what's going on. But it's just, you don't get into that situation that you get to with a lot of these. I came to this, like I say, I've never really read the Marvel Knights imprint. It happened in the 90s when I wasn't doing comics. I knew the name of the imprint because it crops up on things like the Punisher movies and stuff like that. But I want to go back now and enjoy some of these comics because if this is the way that they wrote Marvel Knights comics, I want more of it. It keeps you constantly guessing what the actual reason for this tabula rasa situation is, and it gives you a new take on some familiar characters. And as I say, there are guest appearances from Spider-Man, from Thor, from a whole host of people, but they're not crowbarred in, they're not there for no apparent reason, they're just part of the narrative. And I'll tell you what, when you see cut price Black Panther, it's worth the price of admission. A Black Panther who can't remember who he is and therefore doesn't have his uniform, but wears, you know, those buffs that people wear when they're ruined?
Oh, God.
He's got it across his face.
I was going to say, please say he's wearing cat ears.
No, there's no cat ears. Oh. He's just got a face mask, like a bandit mask, and it's just got panther teeth on it in white. It's brilliant.
Excellent.
It's like season one Daredevil outfit. Imagine a Black Panther version of that. But it is. It's just glorious.
Oh my God. That's the Black Panther in the X-Men film universe.
Yes it is.
So yeah, it's just fantastic. And we meet, you know, the odd X-Man, we meet Tony Stark, who's in prison, by the way.
As well he should be.
Yep, makes sense.
You know, judging from the way he acts, I think he's in prison for being a dick. Seems to be a criminal offence in Hell's Kitchen at the moment.
Again, I can kind of see why that had happened. I can just imagine Tony Stark in a court of law just giving the judge the finger.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's Marvel Knights 20th. Like I say, if you haven't caught the individual issues, it's well worth the read. It's a good collection. And luckily for me, having expressed my wish to read more of these, there's a whole list of collections of Marvel Knights stuff that I'm going to be revisiting soon.
Cool.
Well, clearly Marvel's marketing department have worked their magic on you.
Well, no, what they did was write a good story. It had nothing to do with the marketing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I suppose by marketing, I mean write a good story and then shove a list of other things at the back.
Yeah. So this one is a definite win. It gave me a grin.
Oh, it's the system. It's back.
The system's back.
So, from one disappointing Black Panther to another, I've been reading Black Panther versus Deadpool by Daniel Kibble-Smith with art by Ricardo Lopez-Ortiz and letters by VCs Joe Sabino and colours by Felipe Sobrario. And yeah, this is your classic Marvel superhero misunderstanding dust-up. Something that Deadpool goes to great lengths to point out. So basically what happens is Deadpool is escaping in a school bus full of children from a villain known as the Wrecker when in the ensuing fight he accidentally sends a lump of shrapnel right into the chest of local neighbourhood postman Willie Lumpkin. And turns out the only way to save New York's most beloved of heroes is with an experimental form of vibranium therapy.
Yep.
So, of course, Deadpool goes to the Black Panther to ask for his help. But, of course, being Deadpool, instead of just straight up asking, Black Panther, I need your help, he just annoys Black Panther into having a fight with him. This goes on for 6 issues. it's too long.
Is it basically Marvel's equivalent of the fascio sketch, the long big punch up?
Yes, but not good.
So basically, they managed to stretch out something that should have only lasted 2 pages into 6 whole issues.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the point is, like with the first 3 issues, you get the idea that Deadpool is kind of using his fourth wall breaking to explain how these kind of stories work, which is, first of all, you have the small misunderstanding in issue 1, then issue 2 is the big fight, then issue 3 is our heroes putting aside their differences to defeat a common enemy. In this case, it's Jack-O-Lantern. He has a pumpkin for a head. But then...
he doesn't sound very threatening.
Well, spoiler alert... turns out pumpkins are not impervious to bullets.
Who knew? Oh, wait, almost everybody.
Yep.
Yeah. So I feel like the idea was it supposed to be kind of these 3 issues. But then kind of instead of the story ending, it's like a bit of a swerve into, but no, this series is going to keep going for a bit. But it's another 3 issues of Deadpool fighting Black Panther a bit more. And it's just... I mean, I realise this is partially my own fault, because on the whole, I really don't care for these superhero versus superhero stories.
Yeah.
But I was intrigued because Daniel Kibble-Smith, he did that Lockjaw miniseries.
All right.
And that was tremendous fun.
Yes, it was.
So I thought maybe some of that would carry over. I think the problem is writing Deadpool is kind of a very thin line between, like, amusingly wacky and just a bit grating and annoying. And Daniel Kibble-Smith, he falls on the wrong side of that line. Especially, you know, when this whole story, it literally could have been finished with a conversation.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, is basically how it ends anyway.
Yeah, but this is comic books. They never choose the talking option first.
I know. You know what the problem is?
What?
It does that thing that a lot of ironic things do. Where, like, it points out how cliched something is, but then does the cliched thing anyway.
And do they have Deadpool ironically punching Black Panther in the face?
I mean, basically, it's very much the... I'm pointing out that this is a superhero trope, so it's not like it's just a super, but it is just a superhero trope. You're doing the thing and you're rolling your eyes at the thing, but you're still doing the thing, which just makes it not enjoyable.
They have kind of done those Deadpool versus things to death as well now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is very much just another Deadpool fights a person. So yeah, I was unimpressed. It's a comic book sin. It goes in the bin. That was the phrase.
Yep. So is it my turn?
It is. And remember, your review must stick to the standards of the new system that we made up and didn't tell you about.
Yes, I know. So we will cross that bridge when we get to it. But I have Iceman, Amazing Friends. Now, guess who could be in this? And this is the third trade paperback in the Iceman series, which is written by Sheena Grace, with art by Nathan Stockman, colours by Federico Blee and Andre Mossa, and letters by VC's Joe Sabino. And I have to say, right off the bat, I really like this. I really, really like this. I'm going to say it right now.
That's interesting, because I know a lot of people who are just not a fan of this series.
The series in general, the first two trade paperbacks were a bit slow going, but this one is a lot of fun. And it does go into some areas that I really questioned about the main X-Men storyline. It starts off with Hell's Kitchen. And I really like the take that they're doing on this whole modern mutant thing. And they've said, Hell's Kitchen, New York. There was a time when darkness devoured these sidewalks, when the air rang with gunshots and the violent cries of hapless victims, whatever hapless means. Now it's where lonely gay guys go to strike out to fuel sad boy vibes.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's the opening, right? And in the opening, you have Bobby, who's basically gone cruising, kind of complaining to a woman he's just saved from a fire. Why can't he find a nice man? You know, he's handsome, he's good looking, he's got abs, and he's got superpowers. Why does no one like him? And he's got no answer for that. And you kind of find out more about Bobby's powers in this as well. But one of the things he picks up, one of the people who are torching this shop, is basically a mutant hater. And he picks up this flyer, which looks to have come from the Morlocks, that there's a Morlock missing. And so he wants to investigate, but Kitty and everyone else are busy organizing for the Mutant Pride Parade. And so where he was promised a team, he gets Bishop. And so is born Bobby's new hit TV body cop show of him and Bishop. And so they go to the Morlock tunnels, and they find the Morlocks being attacked by a bunch of other mutants. And this is where it starts getting a little bit weird, because behind these other mutants, right, is Mr. Sinister. But we'll get to Mr. Sinister in a second. Before he does that, he has to help Emma Frost, who is worried about her brother Christian. Did you know Emma Frost had a brother?
Emma Frost has like 27 siblings. I can't keep track of all of them.
But this is her favourite little brother, the one who is not only gay, but has gone through conversion therapy, which made him want to kill himself because their dad forced him to.
That's less fun.
Yeah, I know. So you have this bizarre kind of aside where Bobby's helping Emma rescue her brother Christian from himself, because he's also apparently a very powerful psychic mutant. And then you're introduced to Mr. Sinister, or as I like to call him, Dadrock Sinister, because the current Mr. Sinister has a mullet and a goatee.
Okay.
You're definitely saying words.
Yeah.
Well, Dadrock Sinister used to be obsessed with Jean Grey and Scott Summers, didn't he? But now that Scott's deaded himself, and so Mr. Sinister has decided that Bobby Drake, as an Omega-level mutant, because apparently he is also worthy of study and dissection. And so he decides to ruin Bobby's date with a handsome young fellow called Carlos. But also in the park are Peter Parker, who's on a date with Mary Jane, and Firebird, who's on a date with some random guy.
Firestar. Firebird is a different character who is, again, not a fiery bird.
Firestar, sorry. And so there is a giant, ugly snowman who is chucking cars at them, and so the three of them have to team up in an impromptu team up, which is always fun, and the banter is great. In this team up, they find out it's one of the missing Morlocks, and so Bobby decides he's going to go in all guns blazing, but he also knows he's nowhere near as smart as Mr. Sinister, so he decides to use his lack of smarts against Mr. Sinister.
I mean, this probably makes sense to someone listening, right?
It will make sense to someone listening, because Bobby has abilities that I don't think even he knows about, and he finds out a bit about them later on when Ice Master turns up. Ice Master being Bobby from the future, who was in a relationship with Dakin. Y'all remember Dakin?
No, thank you. I choose not to.
Yeah. And so Dakin became a Thanos-level character because of Ice Master, or Bobby, from the future. And that all leads up to a wonderful bit, right? Because it's Bobby's birthday and everyone's got together to celebrate, including Bobby's parents, who are sitting there and they're having a bit of fun. And it leads to this bit where Bobby is sitting in the pub after he's basically told off Jean Grey for outing him when he was a teenager and his future self for blaming him for stuff that he hasn't even done yet.
That's the real Dark Phoenix.
Yeah, that's the real Dark Phoenix. And so you've got this wonderful scene where Bobby's explaining who Ice Master is. His future self tells him that he's the reason the whole galaxy is put in jeopardy. And you got Ice Master looking at his mom and waving to him. He says, nope, not dealing with any more of this time travel nonsense. And storms off. Because not only now has she seen the teenage Bobby Drake, she's got the normal Bobby Drake and the future old man Bobby Drake to deal with.
Have you got any more of those headache tablets?
Yes.
The special ones.
See, I was fine with this until we started talking about Dark Phoenix, and now I'm not. I still like it. I still think it's a lot of fun because it is. I like Bobby Drake as a character. I think he's a lot of fun. He's an interesting character. Some of the examinations of his character are a lot more in-depth than I expected them to be. And that, to me, is interesting when it comes to comics. I like seeing the characters, you know, the characters develop, the characters grow, the characters actually become something more than what they used to be. And that's what's happening in this one. Yes, he's still wisecracking and everything like that. Him and Johnny Storm are still, you know, knocking around, and Johnny's written a song for his birthday called A Song of Ice and Fire about their friendship.
It's like the Game of Thrones.
Yes. But yeah, it's fun. They gave me a grin. It's a win.
Okay.
I used your rating system, see?
You did. Well done, you. Next time you're away, we'll change it again completely, obviously.
Yeah, I know.
So, is it me now?
Yes.
Probably. I don't know what's going on anymore.
There's too many mutants.
Well, I'm taking you away from mutants, sort of, although there is a cameo from a character that's already been mentioned. So I've been doing Jessica Jones' Purple Daughter, which is by Kelly Thompson, Mattia De Ulis, Philippe Andrade, and Stephanie Petro. And this follows directly on from Blind Spot that I covered a couple of months back. And it's another one of those first-time-in-print digital comics. And it follows Jessica Jones after the shocking revelation at the end of Blind Spot, where her domestic bliss that she found with Luke Cage and daughter Danielle is rocked when Danielle runs into the living room going, "Mummy, Mummy, I'm so pretty," and has turned purple.
That's not good.
Nope.
No.
That's very not good.
No. So naturally, this puts our heroine a little bit on edge. And what I like about this is it makes Jessica go back to her hard-drinking, antisocial ways, but at least you can see why she is the way she is at the moment. You can see why she's on that dark spiral. And Carol Danvers turns up to try and help. So there's a previous plot line that I'm not aware of, but it's not covered in any great depth, but the gist is that the Purple Man was killed, and to make sure he didn't come back, Captain Marvel dropped his corpse into the sun.
Okay.
Now, obviously, with Danielle suddenly turning purple, the fear is that Kilgrave is still around somewhere. So the plot follows Jessica trying to sort this out. And, of course, although she's got Luke Cage there as the supporting partner, she's aware that he's having doubts because, you know, they might have expected a mixed-race baby, but not mixed purple race. They encounter the children of Kilgrave, who are just some kids around New York who happen to have purple skin. They've clearly been encountered before on and off and are harmless.
Yeah, I think they showed up in Daredevil.
Yeah. And there's also an acknowledged daughter called Kara, who Jessica tries to get some information from, but has to do it in a very violent way, because apparently her powers don't work underwater, so she has to nearly drown her in the river. She even calls in a favour from the White Queen. And what I like about the humour in this run of Jessica Jones is whenever a new character is introduced, they have this lovely way of tying it back to Jessica's job as a PI. So they kind of overlay sort of Polaroid photographs over key elements of the character with little notes on that person. And when Emma Frost turns up, the Polaroids are marked, and I kid you not, telepathic powers, leather pant powers, the thing I need, and possible boob powers. So anyway, I don't want to spoil the ending, because figuring out what's going on is definitely a rewarding read. But this is right. It was a perfect companion piece with the Marvel Knights piece, because it's dark, it's gritty, it's emotionally quite disturbing. Obviously, Luke's having all these doubts. You know, is it possible that it's Kilgrave's kid, not his? And of course, Jessica's convinced it's not, but she's aware that she can't possibly be sure. And then Carol Danvers starts having doubts, because knowing what Kilgrave's power is, has he managed to dupe her into killing an innocent person and putting their body in the sun? So all these people have got all this guilt welling up about things they might have done because they thought they were free of Kilgrave, when actually he could have been manipulated. It's a fantastic little web of doubt and intrigue, with a really satisfying payoff at the end. And I look forward to more of this run of Jessica Jones, if there is any, because it's really enjoyable. And
I think it's still ongoing. It kind of comes out just every now and then.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's Jessica Jones' Purple Daughter. Like I say, it follows directly on from Blind Spot. And it made me grin. It's a comic book win.
Okay, well, time's getting on, so I've got time to just slide in a quick review for Runaways. That Was Yesterday, which is the third volume of Rainbow Rowell and Chris Anker's series, with a guest star for two of the issues by David Lafayette and Takeshi Miyazawa, and colours by Jim Campbell and Michael Garland, with additional colours for the last few issues by Matthew Wilson, and letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. So this falls on directly from the end of the last volume. The Runaways' former member Alex Wilder, who betrayed the team way back when, is back and back from the dead and on the run. And he's looking for the help of his former friends, because it turns out he's being chased by three beings known as the Giborim, who are, these are the children of a race of aliens who were in contact with the Runaways' parents during the original series to get them to sacrifice all life on the planet. And now their kids have arrived to demand that the Runaways do the same as part of their ancestral bargain. So the team have got to kind of figure out, first of all, can they trust Alex, given that he tried to kill them all before? And B, how did they not kill everyone on the planet? And it's... to us, compared to the first two volumes, this one was a bit of a slump for me.
Okay.
It's lots of... Well, first of all, the plot feels like a bit of an excuse plot. Like, it maybe should be bigger than it is. Because this is basically like essentially a sequel to the original Runaways series. But the whole thing, I mean, it's introduced and wrapped up just in these six issues. So it feels quite abrupt. And a lot of it is just the characters sitting around and arguing. And it feels like, you know, quite a lot of not really that necessary angsting. Because, I mean, I think anyone reading this is going to be quite aware the team are not going to sacrifice the souls of everyone on Earth.
It would be quite against character, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. And something that I think might impact other Marvel books.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right.
So it's just... I mean, I guess it's another one of those things where it needs to be six issues so it can fill a trade.
Yeah.
But it feels like either this should have been a longer and more complicated story or just wrapped up a bit quicker. And especially I think it requires that you ignore, because I've read some other comics with Alex Wilder in them, where he's been portrayed as just a flat-out supervillain. And I think you kind of have to ignore that a bit to sort of justify why the Runaways don't immediately just, like, sock him in the face. But it's still, on the whole, I still enjoyed it. There's lots of nice character moments. And my favourite character, Doombot, he's back. He gets a great bit, because there's one issue set at Christmas, where they're all kind of discussing what they're going to do. And basically, the main thing they decide is the easiest way to get out of it is to just kill one of the Ghiborim, because that will end the pact. And then it just cuts to Doombot yelling, let me just find it. Oh no, I can't find it. Yeah. Doombot just says, this is a very good plan. We will stain the threshold with its blood. It's going to be a Latverian Christmas after all. I like Doombot. He's a robot that thinks he's Dr. Doom but knows that he isn't.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it's a robot who is utterly convinced he's Dr. Doom, but is also programmed to know he's not.
Alrighty then.
There's been a common theme in this week's episode.
Yep.
You know, I think I've had the sanest two comics of the lot.
Well, you kind of have, because I can close us out with something interesting.
Anyway, Runaways, I'd still probably say made me grin, it's a comic book win. But not quite as much as the first two volumes.
Okay, that's fair enough. So my turn, is it?
Yeah, let's round the show out with something.
Different. Not comic... Well, it is comic book, but it's not superheroes.
Okay, I was going to... If it's not a comic book, it doesn't really have a place on the show.
Yeah, no. It is comic books, but it's not superheroes, for once. And it makes a really nice change. Back in the 80s, back in the very early 80s, you had three brothers called Gilbert, Jamie, and Mario, or Jaime, as some people pronounce it, and Mario Hernandez. And they came up with a comic book, self-published comic book at the time, called Love and Rockets. And it's basically like a legend in the comic book industry now, isn't it? The whole story of Love and Rockets and how it just became this massive cult series of comic books about life in two areas. The way they broke it down was Gilbert would write the Palomar sections of Love and Rockets, and Jamie would write the Locus sections, which are set in Los Angeles, the Palomar ones being set in a Central American village. And this one that I've got here is by Jamie Hernandez, and it's called Is This How You See Me? And it's basically focusing on two particular characters from Love and Rockets. And they are Maggie and Hopi, or to give them the full names, Margarita Luisa Chascarillo, who's also sometimes called Pearly, but is generally known as Maggie. She was one of the main characters of the Locus sections of Love and Rockets. And she, historically, she worked as a mechanic and went around the world fixing rockets, which is part of why it's called Love and Rockets. The other character is Esperanza Letitia Glass, also known as Hopi, who is a sharp-tongued, adventurous, and also Maggie's best friend and on-and-off lover. And generally, she's quite spiky, but she's a lot of fun. She's played bass in a series of punk bands, and this is a lot about punk. They're middle-aged now, but they've been invited back to their home to have a weekend road trip to attend a punk rock reunion in their old neighborhood. And what it does, it kind of, it does that thing that you see in movies quite often where you have the characters going back to the place where they used to live. And then you have the flashbacks of how they used to be when they were kids. And it intertwines how they were in 1979 when they just met each other and just become friends and they were heavily into the punk scene and how they are now. And it juxtaposes the two really, really well. I love the character designs that Jimmy Hernandez and his brothers have done for Love and Rockets in general. I think Love and Rockets is one of the best comic book series or ongoing comic book series that I've read. I got into it in the 90s when I was at university, and I'm a massive fan of just the whole thing. I love the interplay between the characters. I love the relationships. I love the realism of it. And this is basically, this is my metier. This is just, I read this and there's so many little bits, so many little nods to previous storylines in Love and Rockets. And I will say, it's not really for everybody. It's an interesting introduction, I suppose, if you've never read Love and Rockets before. It'd be an interesting introduction, get an idea of how Love and Rockets is, because there's a lot of Love and Rockets to read. But what I particularly like about this is just its depiction of the relationships between the characters, how they talk to each other, just the little in-jokes that the characters have that they've developed over the years of being friends. There's a great bit towards the end where Maggie is running to get help and trips over, and everyone thinks she's seriously injured because she's holding her face, but she's not. She's just crying because she split her pants. And there's a kind of poignant little bit at the end where you have two of Maggie and Hopi's friends who are in a supermarket just doing some shopping, and one of the songs that comes on is from a band that they all used to follow around like crazy, a punk band called Ape Sex, and now it's being played in a supermarket. And just the comment about how everything has ended now, I love it. It put a grin on my face, definitely. It's an absolute win from me.
No, do it properly, Rob.
No.
Yes.
I don't know the proper way to do it.
Did it make you grin?
Yes.
Then it's a comic book win. It's not that difficult.
But you haven't told me the middle one.
That's on a need-to-know basis.
Nick, what was the middle one? I've forgotten.
It's almost worthwhile. It goes on the charity pile.
That's it.
Is this how you see me? It's part of Love and Rockets. If you're a fan of Love and Rockets like I am, then you absolutely need to read it.
Okay, good stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that brings us to the end of the show.
Yes, it does. So if you want to catch any of our previous episodes or indeed any of the other shows that we do here at The Geek Show, then you'll find them all on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, or on Apple Podcasts or Audio Boom or wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you are listening through any podcast aggregator or through Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating, leave us a review. It does help us improve, does help us with exposure as well. If you are heading over to our website, we do all sorts of other stuff, written reviews and various things like that. We also do video game reviews, so check those out, and you'll find our shop and our Patreon as well. That's it from us for this week. Until next time, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
And we will see you all later.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye now.